rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Sleater, Judge Smith, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please be seated. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session, and it is Wednesday, February 7th, 2024. We have four cases scheduled for our oral argument today. As our marshal said, I'm Judge Wheelock. I'm serving today with Judges Sleater and Schmidt, and we are in courtroom 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. These arguments are recorded. They are live streamed as well as an oral recording that is going to be available on the court's website within about 24 hours. And Marshall, please call the first case today.
All right, the first case this morning is A230906, Robert Jensen et al. Respondents versus Carl Rindelob et al. Appellants.
Okay. And counsel, as you both probably know, you have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 for rebuttal. The podium in the middle does adjust up and down. There's a button there, so feel free to move that. There is also a timer on the podium that will reset according to the time that you have for your argument. And I would ask counsel to please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument as well as your client, so we have that for the record on the oral recording as well. And let us know if there's anything we need to know about pronunciation, pronouns, etc. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning to all of you. I'm Thomas Boyd. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, Carl and Darcy Rindelob. This appeal arises from a bench trial and post-trial rulings relating to the interpretation of the terms of an easement. This easement is located on the respondent's property, and it exists for the benefit of the Rindelobs, providing them with a perpetual right of ingress and egress to White Bear Lake, with rights, quote, including the use of the lakeshore and maintenance of usual dock facilities. These are integrated and interrelated rights that arise from a single easement. The district court erred in two fundamental ways. First, the district court erroneously parsed the Rindelob's rights to use and enjoyment of the easement into two separate and distinct parts. The right of ingress and egress on the one hand, and the rights to use of the lakeshore and maintenance of usual dock facilities on the other. The court then incorrectly focused solely on the right of ingress and egress as if it were a standalone right without any connection to the other rights under the easement. And rather than considering and interpreting the easement as a whole and giving fullest meaning to all of these integrated and interrelated rights, including the use of the lakeshore and maintenance of the usual dock facilities.
Mr. Boyd, can I ask you, isn't that consistent with your client's objection to the pretrial motion, maybe it was motions, I can't remember, the respondent had to expand and consider the dock, and of course your client objected, so you won, and so the judge said, no, we're not going to consider the dock, and so that part of Part A of my question and Part B is, isn't it true that really the language of that part, it is a separate part of the one easement, was really not in contest?
With regard to your first, or in response to your first question, the Rindelob's position was not inconsistent. The issue before the court on the motion to amend was whether or not the Jensens could expand their petition to seek relief in addition to what they had pleaded, which had focused on whether or not the easement could be used for something more than just pedestrian use and whether or not a boardwalk could be constructed on it, as well as whether motor vehicles could be operated. It was not a splicing or a dividing up of the easement. In fact, at that time and throughout the litigation, my clients were very consistent in saying in order to interpret the rights of ingress and egress, you have to consider the easement as a whole. It doesn't, you don't have ingress and egress just for its own sake. You have it in order to facilitate the other rights of lake access and maintaining the ordinary dock facilities. So we were very consistent. We were consistent in that holistic approach as opposed to adopting or advocating a parsed two-part interpretation.
But just to clarify, the issue was the ingress-egress part of the easement. In other words, did it allow for anything more than pedestrian foot traffic? So in that sense, I guess that's why I was asking, the dock itself, a maintenance of the dock was really not a contested issue, though it relates, perhaps, and it looks like from the trial, as I see it, that there was testimony, you know, about the purpose of the ingress-egress, and part of your client's argument is that, of course, we need to maintain a dock in a more modern way than perhaps the dock needed to be maintained 60 years ago.
And have access to and from the dock and the lakeshore in a way that perhaps wasn't capable of being accomplished many decades ago. So that would include bringing a boat across the ingress and egress, or bringing a dock across the easement as part of ingress and egress, but to facilitate the other rights, including lake access and maintaining the dock facility and using the dock facilities.
Thank you.
The other error that the court made was exceeding the scope of that relief that was being sought, and most notably addressing an issue that was not pleaded and was never before the court until the judge actually issued its findings, and that is the issue of storage and whether or not storage could be done on the easement for any purpose. That was something that was never pleaded. The petition was very, very specific in terms of what it was looking for, and it did not address storage in any way, shape, or form. When the first trial took place, the issue of storage was never an issue before the district court. When this case was appealed, it was not put before the court. When they sought to amend their petition, they said that the Jensens indicated they wanted to include all aspects of the easement, including storage. And the court said, no, we're not going to do that. And even on the morning of trial, when the Jensens first raised this issue of a first grant and a second grant and urged the court to only consider the first grant, they argued we need to do that so we don't get into issues relating to how the dock facilities are maintained and the issue of storage. They specifically said that. And then the court heard the evidence, went forward with its findings, and ruled, among other things, that the easement prohibited storage of any sort. It was categorical, saying where the easement will be prohibited, or the easement prohibits all other uses, including but not limited to storage. And that was something that was way beyond what had ever been presented in the case, either by the petition or by the parties. Again, that was not in the petition. It wasn't in the order to show cause. It was not in the first trial. It was not in this appeal. It was not something that was permitted in the motion when the motion to amend was denied. And it was something that on the first day of trial, the parties, the court said, we're not going to be doing that. We're only going to be focusing on these narrow issues. And then in its order said, quote, the use of the ingress-egress easement is limited to pedestrian use only for ingress and egress purposes only, end quote. All other uses and purposes, including but not limited to storage, are prohibited. That is something that went way beyond what was properly before the court. There's been a suggestion that somehow that was tried by consent. We obviously disagree with that characterization and do not think that it can possibly be borne out by the record in this case. I've already gone through the procedural history, which is extensive. The petition doesn't go there. The order to show cause doesn't go there. The first trial didn't go there. The appeal didn't encompass storage. The motion, the denial of the motion to amend excluded that issue. And on the first day of trial, the court said it was not going to go there. The fact that there were one or two mentions of storage by one or two witnesses and there was no objection is not sufficient to make a finding or a determination that that was tried by consent. Those questions were fleeting, and in the context of questions about other aspects of the historic use of the property. And in fact, my client, Dr. Rindelof, testified that he and his wife had regularly used the easement for storage. So they were not capitulating or agreeing to try that issue by consent. That was not a subject that should have been addressed in any way by the court.
Counsel, is it your position that the issue of storage is not part of the scope of a pertinent easement then?
No. That the right to use the pertinent easement for storage is very much a right that falls within the Rindelof's rights under the easement. That's so fundamental to, I think, all aspects, whether it's lake access or maintaining the dock, the usual dock facilities.
And that was the purpose of the remand, right, to explore what the full scope was?
No. The purpose of the remand was to retry the narrow issues presented in the petition, which was whether it was limited to pedestrian use versus motor vehicle, and whether or not improvements like a boardwalk could be constructed. There was no remand on the issue of storage. And in fact, the only reason there was a remand is because the district judge in the first case had declined to take evidence regarding historic use on those two subjects, but not with regard to the use of the easement for storage. And that is very much fundamentally a right under the easement, but it was not a right that the petitioners sought to litigate. We are seeking a remand for a retrial with instructions to the court to focus on, or to consider the easement as a whole and to limit its determinations to just those issues presented by the petition, by the petitioners. In the alternative, and at the very least, we would ask the court to remand with instructions to the district court to excise or remove those portions of the court's findings of fact, conclusions of law, and orders that would purport to go beyond the relief that was sought by the petitioners, and specifically and most notably remove any restrictions purportedly imposed on the right to use the easement for storage. And we've specifically identified those portions of the findings, conclusions, and order in our submissions.
Boyd, can I ask you, you characterized in your brief that as a defect, that the court did not consider the easement as a whole. But I didn't read it that way, and maybe you can help me with this. And the reason I'm asking, again, this kind of goes to my first question. The contested issue, and the very narrow issue as you described it, was whether ingress or egress meant more than walking, essentially.
Yes.
And so that necessarily meant we didn't need to interpret, the judge didn't need to interpret. I assume that was part of the judge's reasoning, not having to define. But how does that necessarily mean that the judge didn't take into account the easement as a whole? I mean, everybody knew there was that portion of
yes.
the easement, but interpreting it was not to be counted. So what different would the judge have done, I guess is what I'm questioning, to make up for that mistake that you're saying it made?
Well, I'll try and be as responsive as I can. The court at the outset, at the first day of trial, said it was only going to consider the first grant. In the order that the district court entered after the trial, the judge said, as I ruled, I'm only going to consider the first grant, not going to consider the second grant. But then the judge went on to say, but What we determine with regard to the first grant will be imposed on the second grant, and the second grant can only be exercised in a way that's consistent with my rulings on the first grant.
Why would that be an error, I guess is my question, because wouldn't that naturally follow that if only foot traffic historically has been the purpose of the easement, then that mean only feet can get to that dock and not
both? He said that was the only purpose with regard to ingress and egress. But the law says you have to apply all of the rights in their fullest extent. So when he said it's only used, that this ingress and egress portion of the easement is only used for foot traffic, and I'm now going to impose that same restriction on the rest of the easement, that's doing the opposite of applying those rights in their fullest way. Instead, he's saying, I haven't even addressed the second bundle of rights, but presumptively I'm going to impose restrictions on it based on my findings on the first piece of this easement.
That's my question. Doesn't that naturally follow? In other words, again, the contested issue was whether the ingress and egress allows for anything more than feet. Then that resolves the issue of what can be transported, which is your feet, to that dock.
Right.
Maybe a canoe over top like the BWCA, I suppose.
Right, and that's focusing just on the ingress and egress as opposed to what is appropriate for ingress and egress in order to have full lakefront use and maintaining the dock facility, which would include a boat, which would include bringing a boat back and forth, and a canoe maybe on your head, but a motorboat, a pontoon, all of those are far more narrow than the 15-foot width of this easement and would be appropriate for maintenance of a dock facility. Likewise, being able to bring equipment relating to maintaining the dock facility. Depending on what that is, it may be something that you can carry by foot, but it could also likely be something that requires its own mode of transportation, whether it's a golf cart or a small tractor or something of that sort. I see my time is done. I appreciate this, and thank you.
Thank you, Council. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We turn next to Council for the respondent. Feel free to adjust the podium as you wish. There are 15 minutes on the clock, and once you're ready, you may begin.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, Tom Atmore on behalf of the respondents, Jane and Robert Jensen, as trustees for the Jane M.H. Jensen Trust. The Rindelob's argument here rests on a false premise, and Judge Sleater, I think you were getting at it, and that is the language of the easement and the overwhelming testimony as to the intent of that ingress and egress portion. There was no dispute on that, literally no testimony contrary to the fact that it was only for pedestrian use. No document, no testimony from any witness that contradicted that. And that's what the district court based the decision on, the evidence, including the document. And the false premise is that this easement is for the purpose of having a dock. It's not. That's not what it says. They state on page one of their initial brief that this appeal concerns their rights, quote, rights in an appurtenant easement on the Jensen's property for perpetual ingress and egress across a strip of land 15 feet wide, and I'm going to emphasize this last part, to use the lakeshore and maintain the usual dock facilities. So they want that to be the easement, as if it said, you're granted ingress and egress for the purposes of maintaining a dock at the shoreline. That's not what this easement says, and the district court recognized it, and that's what the district court based all its rulings on, the evidence, the language of the easement, and what it saw from the witnesses and the documents presented. So, and this is nowhere better highlighted, actually, that if you look at Exhibit 7 to the trial exhibit 7, And what that document is the reconveyance, there's a unique history here of how this came to be. It was a grant essentially from a father to a daughter and son-in-law. And the father owned the company, the Hermstead Company, that was going to develop this land. And so the Hermstead Company was retaining the burdened estate, but giving an easement to the daughter and son-in-law. And it was originally given in the mortgage, or excuse me, in the warranty deed. The easement was contained in the warranty deed. They then backed it out of that. They took it out and reconveyed a different easement, and that's highlighted in Trial Exhibit 7. It's the reconveyance of the under the mortgage, so they're giving the original easement back. And that original easement said, a perpetual easement for ingress and egress to the lakeshore White Bear Lake, including the right to use of the lakeshore and the right to maintain the usual dock facilities over and on a tract, and then it describes the property. Very broad. Lower in on the first page of Exhibit 7 is the quitclaim deed that gives a different easement to the Wands. And that easement says that it's for a perpetual easement for ingress and egress across a strip of land, and then it describes the property. And then a separate clause, this easement shall also include the right to maintain the usual dock facilities on said 15-foot strip on the shore of White Bear Lake. So it very much limited that. It limited that second part. It limited that second grant. And it said, it took away the use of the shore. That was no longer in there. And it limited the right to maintain just on the lakeshore. Whereas the prior one, right to maintain wasn't limited to just the lakeshore. And that's really what this Judge Green is getting at here. Judge Green really understands how this easement was intended to work.
Mr. Epler?
Yes.
It does seem like it was a kind of a self-imposed limitation that the judge, by not talking about the dock, because necessarily everyone agrees that that is part of the easement, whether you call it the second grant,
yep,
and the usual dock facilities, and a dock in Minnesota is for boats, and boats aren't easily pulled by hand, and how do you get it there? It just strikes me that at least it's a reasonable argument that in order to interpret the ingress egress, you have to consider testimonial. Well, what do we do with a dock? What's the usual maintenance of a dock? And then that helps to answer what we use the ingress egress to do the usual maintenance of a dock. But yet the judge denied that. How do we make such a clean break?
Yes,
when it's all in the one paragraph easement.
And it's actually two paragraphs. That's kind of my point, but I'll answer your question, and that is the fact of the second grant was part of the trial. In other words, yes, there is a grant of the right to maintain the usual dock facilities on the shore. The Rindelobs said, don't let the scope of that part into the case. And so the judge denied our motion to amend the petition. They then come to trial, and in their trial memorandum say, we want to talk about the scope of that second easement, because that's really important. So they wanted to exclude us from talking about it, but then they wanted to talk about it, having prevented us from doing any discovery, etc. So the judge was faced with this quandary that was completely of the Rindelobs' making. And the solution is that you do just what the district court did, and that is you look at all the evidence as to ingress and egress, you recognize the fact that there is a right to maintain the usual dock facilities on the shore, but you're not going to say, because they told you not to, and you agreed not to, you're not going to rule on the scope of that. What kind of dock? Do you get to have these enormous lifts? Do you get to put them on the shore? Do you get to have hundreds of feet of dock? You know, that's scope. The fact that there is the right to maintain some sort of dock is agreed. The question is scope, and they wouldn't allow it in the case. So then all the evidence, everything, is about the use of that over time, including the second grant. How was it? There wasn't a dock till the Renlubs came there. So all the evidence said ingress and egress was pedestrian only. Well, that's got to impact that second grant, as you pointed out, Judge. How could you come to any other conclusion? Stating, well, you know, I get to have a giant boat, or the only way I could get it down there is a certain way. That doesn't impact that, because all the evidence was contrary to that.
But my question is, why isn't it an error that the judge denied your motion? And I realize maybe the Renlubs now wish they wouldn't have objected, but my point being is just what you factually pointed out. The fact that historically there was no need for anything more than foot traffic was probably because there was never put a dock there, but clearly the easement allows for usual dock. And so then the question becomes, if you're not looking at both parts together, are you really getting a true historical and intention of this entire easement absent that evidence?
Yes, and I think you are, because I think for two reasons. One is we did look at all the historical evidence, and people did talk about how the lakeshore was used on this easement, including Mr. Binger, who's part of the Juan Binger
family.
You
said that was absent a dock.
Well, they didn't install a dock, that's true, but they did talk about how it was used and how the shoreline was used. So they talked about that second grant. And so you can't force an issue to trial that you asked not to be part of the trial. The Renlubs did that. And they created this very issue, and the judge, district court judge, did a very good job, we think, of just very limited impact of what the first easement, or first grant on the second. The judge did not address the full scope of that second easement because they asked him not to. But they also asked for a very broad ruling. They specifically asked for a very broad ruling, and judge, tell us what our rights are. Tell the parties what the rights are, and clarify what the rights are. And he did just that. And you know, if a litigant asks for relief in a general way, please rule, judge. And then the judge rules. You can argue that the ruling was incorrect if you've got a legitimate basis for doing so. But I think you can't do what they're doing, and that is say he shouldn't have ruled. They asked him to rule, and to come here and say, well, he shouldn't have, I think it ignores what the request was. And they did it repeatedly, gave us a broad ruling. Please clarify. Please state clearly what it is, or the rights are. And he does just that, and he did it correctly. They created the very problems that they're complaining about, and I think the judge read the text of the easement and looked at the evidence and decided the issues that, frankly, the Renlubs wanted decided, including the fact that they didn't want him to decide the full scope of that second grant, and he didn't. All he said was all the evidence shows that the second grant, that the first grant can't be used in a way, or the second grant can't be used or suggest a way that the first grant gets broadly used. It's just as simple as that. And they requested, both by excluding that from the trial and by asking for the broadest possible ruling and addressing it, clarity, and give us clarity, Judge. The Renlubs requested it, and that's why he did what he did.
Even if they asked for a broad ruling, though, how is storage properly before the district court when it wasn't part of the initial petition?
Yes. So, in fact, A couple of answers to that, Judge Schmidt. First, as Judge Wheelock pointed out, the remand was literally, I think this is the quote, remand to determine the scope of the pertinent easement. It wasn't remand to determine whether a boardwalk can be built or pedestrian use only or no motor vehicles. It was scope of the pertinent easement. Second, the request in the petition, one of them, was pedestrian use only. Please rule that it's for pedestrian use only and no motor vehicle use and no more, but pedestrian use only. And that's key because by definition, that excludes everything else. So you can't, you know, after you've asked for these broad rulings, give me clarity, come in and say, no, this, we should have been so focused on just these two issues, boardwalk and pathway and motorized vehicle use. No, it said pedestrian use only. That's what we asked for. So what does that preclude? Storage. The use of it for a trailer and a car. Any other use. So this isn't where there was a request for just a very specific ruling as to just motor vehicles. It was pedestrian use only. That was the request. And once you go that broad, you can't come back and narrowly say, well, no, wait, you can't rule on storage. Well, storage is contrary to pedestrian use only. And storage is, and driving a trailer in a car down is contrary to pedestrian use only. So those issues were in the case. And they were litigated by consent, and we've cited, and there was an argument, by the way, in their initial brief that we didn't raise this in the district court. We, in fact, did. You can see it in our response to the motion for a new trial. We cite the record where we repeatedly ask these questions that go to what does pedestrian use only mean? And that is no storage, no trucks, no cars, no improvements. We asked of virtually every witness, and it was without objection. And so that's why it's okay and perfectly reasonable for the district court to have concluded what it did. It was part of the case. It was litigated. They made no objection. And the evidence was overwhelming. I see my time is up.
Counsel, I do have one question for you.
Yes.
Do you think this is an appropriate case for a precedential opinion?
I haven't thought of it, but I guess my reaction is it's not particularly raising anything unique. Mm-hmm. It's unique to its particular facts, including the unique circumstances of the grant of the easement. With the first to grant, then you take it back, and then you grant a second, a different easement, and so forth. The overwhelming evidence, there really isn't a dispute about the evidence. So overall, I guess, standing here today, and I might change my mind in 5 minutes, but I would say probably not.
Thank you.
Thank you
for your argument. And we will turn to counsel for appellant for 5 minutes of rebuttal. The clock is reset. And if you could also answer that question, Mr. Boyd, to start with.
I confess I have not given it a lot of thought, but I would say yes. I think it would be helpful to the bench and bar to have further guidance in terms of how to address these types of interpretive issues relating to easements. First, with regard to adjudicating the issue of storage by consent, both parties have cited basically the same Supreme Court cases, which counsel this court and the district courts to take care when it considers that issue and to err on the side of finding that the party has not tried the case by consent or tried the issue by consent. The Jensens have cited to portions of the transcript. I would urge you to take a look at those. Only a handful of the page sites actually deal with storage, only two or three witnesses even responded, and those were limited to one question. They also include testimony by Dr. Rindelof saying, no, it has been used for storage. But that was not sufficient to try that issue by consent. Fundamentally, one of the most important points here is that the Rindelofs are not the petitioners. The Jensens are. There's a lot of discussion by the Jensens counsel about how the Rindelofs brought this all upon themselves. That's a false paradigm. We are not the petitioner. We are not the party seeking relief. The petitioner set forth the relief that it's seeking in its petition. That was reflected by the district court in the order to show cause. That was further reflected by the two narrow issues that were tried in the first case. That was further reflected by this court's opinion, which remanded for retrial, for a second trial, of those two narrow issues, not for everything. Otherwise, on remand, petitioners wouldn't have sought to move to amend their petition. If this court sent it back for a trial on all aspects of the easement, there would be no need for them to move to amend their petition. And in their motion, they say we want to amend it to include everything, including storage. That's an admission and a recognition by petitioners that storage wasn't properly in the case. And then on the very first, and that motion was denied. The judge said, we're going to keep it narrow based on your petition. We're not going to go into anything else. And then on the first day of trial, when they argued first grant, second grant, they said you have to parse it out and only look at the first grant. Otherwise, we're going to have to get into issues relating to storage.
But how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that if we're looking at whether or not it's limited to pedestrian use only, mm-hmm. then that inherently implicates all of the other potential uses?
For the reasons I've just stated, in terms of the narrow relief they were seeking and the fact that the court, the district court, said we're not going to expand it to other aspects. Secondly, as an independent matter, pedestrian traffic is independent. It's unrelated to whether or not there's a right to use the space, the easement, for storage. You can store things relating to the use, the right to use lake, to have lake access, or to maintain the usual dock facilities, regardless of whether you're getting there by pedestrian traffic or some other means, regardless of whether you're bringing in something to store from the lake. The dock itself, the boat lift, those are all appropriate things that are commonly stored in connection with the maintenance of the usual dock facilities. And whether you're bringing those things in from storage from the lake or across the property via foot traffic, it matters not. That does not impose a restriction on storage. So I would reject the proposition that the Jensens advanced, that when you ask for one thing that excludes everything else, that would turn a blind eye to everything, the entire procedural history of this case, from the petition to the order to show cause to the first trial to this court's order for remand to the denial of their request to amend, to say we want something more than just a determination on pedestrian only. We want to know about, or we'd like a ruling on storage. And that was not changed by anything the Rindelofs did as the respondent, not the petitioner.
Counsel, I have a question about the district court's order. One of the things I'm struggling with for your position for reversing is that the district court found several of the historical witness testimony to be credible and then came to the ruling that it did. How do you get around those credibility determinations to still prevail?
Again, I would urge the court to look at the testimony that underlies that potential or that finding. First of all, Mr. Binger, he just said his family never used the property for storage. And then the city attorney said, well, I'm not aware that it was used for storage. That's it. Ms. Jensen said it wasn't used for storage, but then Mr. Jensen said it was. And Carl Rindelhoff said, we've been using it for storage. So finding, if that finding on the credibility of witnesses fairly relates to storage, that should not have been something that the court was deciding.
And if I may, I want to back up from storage and take the broader view of your entire argument, and where those credibility findings went to both the ingress, egress, and the other issues, not just storage. And
then,
so,
excuse me. Then I would urge the court to again evaluate that finding to determine whether or not those findings of credibility are fairly applied to truncate and restrict the so-called second grant of rights, simply because there's a finding that Mr. Binger was a credible witness does not mean that it's a reasonable interpretation of the party's intent or a reasonable interpretation of a fair way of exercising these rights to say no storage, no boardwalk, no development of the lakefront, no exercise of those rights, essentially, because we're limiting the ingress and egress in this way. The court should have recognized the limitations of what was being sought in the petition and its own rulings, that it was only going to address the first grant, and not go on to say, and we're going to interpret the second grant in a way that is likewise restricted. I hope that's responsive.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for the additional time.
Yes, thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel and parties for the argument today and for the briefs that were submitted. We will take the matter under advisement, and an opinion will be issued in the statutory timeframe.